Welcome to WRFG Atlanta, 89.3 FM on your dial. Next up, Alternative Perspectives, Atlanta's only queer radio hour. Hold on tight. And thank you so much for joining us today on WRFG Atlanta 89.3 FM. You are listening to Alternative Perspectives. This is Atlanta's only local radio hour devoted exclusively to issues affecting Atlanta's queer community. I am your host, Greg Bossen, and I am still queer. Thank you so much for listening. The opinions expressed here, as always, are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily represent the views of WRFG, its employees, board, volunteers, funders, or listeners. So before we get into the news, I'm really excited about the show tonight. We have an author by the name of Alon Green who wrote a book called Last Call. And this is a book that was released in March, and it's about a serial killer and a string of murders in New York City happening between 1991 and 94. He was called the Last Call Killer because he worked out of, or I guess I should say, killed out of bars, particularly one bar in New York City called the Townhouse. And he would take unsuspecting men back to his place, kill them, dismember their bodies, and then dump them. And the case didn't get a lot of attention. It took years to solve. And this book chronicles the crimes, why it is that it was so difficult to solve, and in the process really focuses on what life was like for gay men in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, certainly in the 90s in New York City. It's a great read. It's very compelling. And fortunately, the man was eventually caught. But so we are going to have the author on the show tonight. I'm very excited about that. But before we get into that,
news of the queer.
I know that's right.
Oh, no, she didn't say what.
So before we get into the news, the most important thing I wanted to discuss is COVID. Sorry. But the Delta variant is running rampant. And for those of you that are tired of hearing about it, too bad. Our 7-day average now in the state of Georgia is over 3,000 cases a day. The last time it was this high was in February of 2021. And so we are on the way up with no signs of it stopping. The Delta variant is scary because it does appear that even though you've been vaccinated, you can still get the virus. Now, fortunately, you'll either have no symptoms or few symptoms. Chances of you going in the hospital are next to nil and certainly not dying. So it's definitely better to get the vaccination. So the first thing I want to say is please reconsider the anti-vaxxer crowd, the people that listen to this station that only put wholesome things in their body and are very concerned and mistrustful of the government. Please rethink because you wouldn't be taking the vaccination just for you. You would be taking it for those around you as well, because it turns out that if you are infected, you can spread this thing in addition to hurting yourself and your family. So please stop being stupid. And also, I do think that it's wise to start wearing masks again. I know it sucks. Even if you've been vaccinated is what I'm talking about now. Certainly, if you haven't been vaccinated, you need to wear a mask. But if you have been vaccinated, like I have, we need to wear masks also. All right. So, and then moving on, and obviously we've all heard about this. This was on Friday. A bartender at Capignoglia, that's the Italian restaurant on the corner of Piedmont and 10th, a 40-year-old gay woman by the name of Catherine Janice, was found stabbed and killed early Wednesday as she walked her dog in Piedmont Park. This happened at around midnight. The dog was stabbed as well. Crime Stoppers is offering a $10,000 reward for information helping Atlanta police solve the murder of Catherine Janice. Her body, along with her dog Bowie, who was also killed in the attack, was found near the 10th Street and Charles Allen Drive entrance to the park. That's that main entrance to the park on 10th Street with the big pillars. She was found around 1 a.m. Janice's wife discovered the bodies after she tracked Janice's cell phone to the park. The couple live within a mile of the park. Janice was stabbed repeatedly in what a veteran homicide detective described to WSB as an out-of-the-ordinary and gruesome scene. On Thursday, Atlanta police asked the public's help. Police released an image of Janice walking her dog along the rainbow crosswalks at the intersection of 10th Street and Piedmont Avenue, captured on a security camera before she was killed. Callers to Atlanta police, which is 404-546-4235, or Crime Stoppers, which is 404-577-TIPS, T-I-P-S, can remain anonymous. Emma Clark, Janice's partner of nearly 6 years, wrote that she has lost the love of her life. This is just awful, horrible, more than 200 donors it's certainly more than 200 now, have raised, I think the GoFundMe campaign has close to $30,000-$40,000 at this point. But you can go to the GoFundMe campaign and look up Catherine Janice. I'm sure you'll find it there. You can make a contribution to help pay for the funeral expenses and any other expenses in connection with this, trying to help out trying to help out her partner. So sad and horrible. And so we'll be following that and seeing what happens. One thing that I do want to stamp out is there is a social media post that is saying that this is part of there's a serial killer out. And that is definitely not true. See, not long after there was another body found in Stone Mountain Park. I didn't know that it was in Stone Mountain Park. I don't think it was, but there was another body found, and the two deaths are completely unrelated. But there is a post going around social media saying that there is a serial killer in Atlanta killing and mutilating women. And this is not true. There's no connection between the stabbing in Piedmont Park and this other body that was found. And I'm looking to see where the other body was found. Let's see. Maybe it was in Stone Mountain Park. That's kind of surprising. I didn't think that it was. But anyway, so I just wanted to throw that out there to make sure that you understand that at this point anyway, there's not the cops, the FBI have no reason to believe that there's a serial killer. So on the loose. All right. So just wanted to make sure that you understood that. All right. Moving on, we're going to keep the news kind of local today. So thought I'd give you a little bit of good news. In Athens, Georgia, there is a vote that is happening. It may have just happened by the time you're listening to this, and I don't know the result, but the vote is to bring LGBTQ inclusive non-discrimination ordinances to Athens. There's another one that is to occur in Columbus, Georgia, but this is kind of exciting. So two of Georgia's six largest cities stand poised to adopt sweeping LGBTQ inclusive non-discrimination ordinances, bringing protections to some 300,000 more residents. Let's see. A similar effort in the state's second largest city stalled. That would be Columbus, over concerns on how to enforce the policy. Such policies are already in place across Georgia in 12 municipalities, with 11 passing in the last 3 years. Policies ban discrimination based on sexual orientation, gender identity, race, religion, and several other factors in private employment, housing, and accommodation, and public accommodations. The complaint process, fines, and revocation of business licenses vary by ordinance. Several call for tracking hate crimes as well. The Athens-Clark County Commission voted today on its non-discrimination ordinance during a meeting, but I don't know what the result of that is. But that is Atlanta's sixth most popular state, and they feel good about it. It's likely to pass unanimously. So perhaps by the time you're listening to this at 7 o'clock, it's a little bit earlier at this moment, you will have Athens will have passed this thing. So that's very, very cool. So in Columbus, though, the Columbus City Council member Walker Garrett also hopes to pass a non-discrimination ordinance in his city, the state's third largest, in August. But religious groups are trying to derail the effort over the measure's inclusion of LGBTQ protections. It all seems to be centered on the gender identity and sexual orientation inclusion in the measure. Garrett, Columbus's LGBTQ liaison, Garrett, Columbus's LGBTQ liaison, J.C. Jenkins, and other city officials have pushed for the measure since at least January of last year. The council originally scheduled the ordinance for consideration in May of this year, but the council delayed it over opposition from the local Chamber of Commerce and some council members. The council passed an anti-discrimination resolution instead, leaving out the LGBTQ portion. The chamber then hosted a forum about the ordinance in July. Speakers included Garrett, Mayor Skip Henderson, Chamber President Gerald Mitchell, and LGBTQ strategist Kathy Woolard. We need to have her on the show. Woolard, the first openly LGBTQ elected official in Georgia history, was instrumental in Atlanta adopting a non-discrimination policy in 2000 when she served as president of the Atlanta City Council. So Garrett, a Republican, said the forum went well, but religious organizations, including local churches and vocally anti-gay Faith and Freedom Coalition, objected to the inclusion of LGBTQ people in the ordinance. "I can't believe people are using religious arguments like this," Garrett says. "I am a Baptist deacon," and quoted scripture and said the ultimate commandment is to love your neighbor like yourself. So we'll see what happens with that. He's surprised. I am not. And then finally, and this is just something that this is a poll that came out recently. Americans are deeply divided over transgender rights. Data released last Tuesday has shown, with experts accusing politicians of exploiting clear differences along party lines to foment a culture war over the issue in recent years. Seven Republican U.S. states have barred trans competitors from girls' sports. However, let me give you this poll here. The number of respondents who said they personally knew someone trans rose to 42% from 37% in a previous poll in 2017. But despite the intense public debate in recent years, more than half of those surveyed say gender is determined solely by sex at birth as opposed to transition, about the same proportion as 4 years ago. So that's something we definitely need to keep an eye on. We got a lot of learning to do as a society as it relates to trans. And that's it for the news, and we will be right back.
Some folks like to get away, take a holiday from the neighborhood, hop a flight to Miami
taking a greyhound on the Hudson River line.
Following is a public affairs bulletin board announcement from your station for progressive information and hand-picked quality music, WRFG 89.3 FM, WRFG.org. Some 1,100 miners at the Warrior Met Coal facilities in Brookwood, Alabama, have been on strike since April 1st. Their list of grievances against the company is long and includes many health and safety concerns, as well as low wages and extreme working hours. The miners have maintained 24-hour picket lines despite company harassment and intimidation since the beginning of the strike. The United Mine Workers of America, UMWA, is calling for a show of working class and union solidarity on Wednesday, August 4th, in Brookwood, Alabama. The Georgia State AFL-CIO and the Atlanta North Georgia Labor Council are providing bus transportation to the rally. The buses will leave from the IBEW parking lot, 501 Pulliam Street Southwest, at 7 a.m. on August 4th and return at the conclusion of the rally to Atlanta. To make a reservation, the telephone numbers are 404-525-2793 or 404-522-4141. Again, to attend the August 4th rally in support of Warrior Met striking miners in Brookwood, Alabama, the numbers to reserve a seat on the bus are 404-525-2793 or 404-522-4141.
And welcome back to those of you that are just joining us. You are listening to WRFG Atlanta 89.3 FM, streaming at WRFG.org. And this is Alternative Perspectives. This is Atlanta's only queer radio hour. I'm your host, Greg Bossen. And tonight's show. So this is something we're going to be highlighting a book this show, and it's a book that came out in March. It's called Last Call, a true story of love, lust, and murder in queer New York. Now, the book recounts a serial killer known as the Last Call Killer, who brutally murdered and dismembered four gay men in New York City between 1991 and 1993. This happened in New York City, although the bodies were actually dumped outside of New York, which is one of the reasons why it took so long to solve the case, one of the many reasons. The killer was eventually caught in 2001 and is presently serving a 65-year sentence, which is basically life. One of the things that was so remarkable about these crimes, in addition to the brutality of the murders, was how little attention was received either by the press or by the NYPD. And with us on the show tonight, and that's why I think this is important to highlight this on the show, and also the book was excellent. With us on the show tonight is the author of Last Call, Elan Green, whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, and The Atlantic. He lives in New York City. And so do I call you Sean or Elan? I know you
It's Elon. I don't know where Sean came from.
Oh, okay. I thought I heard somebody call you Sean. Okay, well, then I'll definitely call you Elon. All right. So, first of all, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate you taking the time.
Now, thanks for having me.
Of course. Now, this is your first book. And I wanted to ask you specifically, first of all, how did you come across this story in the first place? And why is it that you chose to write about it? I'm just kind of curious as to how that happened.
I happen to be reading a back issue, old issue of The Advocate from the mid-90s. And it was a cover story about anti-gay violence. And it was a long 8 or 9 page story, and about halfway through, there were 3 paragraphs about an unsolved crime, of men being killed and dismembered and left in trash barrels outside of New York City. And they had, you know, very quick sketches of the men who were killed. And I was immediately intrigued, just because they were all different and they came from different cities. They had different jobs. And I was shocked that I hadn't heard of the case. And I figured out what it was and realized that years later it had been solved and that nobody had written about it in 20 years.
Wow. And it, just out of curiosity for the listeners, you know, you are straight, you're married. What were you doing reading in the back of The Advocate in the 90s?
I had done a story, about 7 years ago about an unsolved string of murders in San Francisco called the Doodler Murders. And, doing that story, I had gotten very used to reading The Advocate, and it was a great paper. And so it's not uncommon for me to flip through back issues because the writing and editing is wonderful. And
wow. You
know, what better way to find stories that, you know, not that many people read the back issue of The Advocate. So for me, that's where I find a lot of stuff.
One thing that struck me is, you know, you were surprised that you hadn't heard about it. And indeed, I've spoken to some of my friends since reading the book, and you know, one guy in particular who lived in New York during that time and didn't know about it. So he was surprised. I wasn't, only because of the way that gay violence against gay men has been treated in the past, certainly in the time period.
Well, yes, I am no longer surprised.
Yeah. But initially, so now the name of the book, Last Call, comes from the killer's nickname, with the Last Call Killer. And this is because, well, basically he picked up his victims from gay bars, and one in particular in New York City called the Townhouse. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the history of the bar, which is still open, by the way, which really surprised me.
Yeah, well, first of all, I should say that although the title sort of nominally comes from, you know, the name The Last Call Killer, the reason I chose it is I also felt that Last Call was the time of night when these men were at their most vulnerable. And so it also said something about who the target of, you know, these crimes were.
Yeah.
It said something about them and their vulnerability. The Townhouse is so interesting. It was founded in 1989, and very few people who used to go to that bar or go to the bar now realize that it was founded so relatively recently. Because if you've been there, it feels like something out of the 40s or 50s. The day it opened, there were, you know, old-looking couches, expensive old-looking carpet, oil paintings on the wall, and piano players singing songs from the 30s and 40s. And it just, it was at the time, you know, New York was really on the cusp of a new era of gay bars and clubs. A club called Splash would open, I believe, in 1991. And that is considered to be sort of the first true 90s club and gay club. And so for the time period, the Townhouse was a real throwback.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. And makes it interesting for sure. And I wanted to give I feel like it's important to say the names of at least the four victims. I mean, who knows if there's more? You know, that's one of the problems. We don't really know because of the way New York City kind of slapped down on this guy before we had a chance to follow him when it finally happened. But I wanted to give these four names, Peter Anderson, Thomas Mulcahy, Anthony Moraro, and Michael Sicara, who was a regular at the Townhouse.
At the Five Oaks, actually.
Oh, at the Five Oaks. Yeah, that's right. Not the Townhouse, the Five Oaks. That's right. Yeah, and one of the and actually, I'll go ahead and ask this now, because you spend quite a bit of time talking about, like, as you're reading the book, we learn about the victims, and we certainly learn a lot about what it was like to be gay in New York City in the 90s, but also in other towns as you cover. I think Youngstown, Ohio was one that you
Philadelphia, you spent... South Boston.
Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, how did, and it's really interesting, how did you come to decide to, is that something that just kind of evolved organically as you were writing?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to, the impetus for it originally was that I wanted to show how they became who they were. And I wanted to show the, you know, to the extent that they were a product of their time and place, I wanted to show, you know, like what they were escaping and what they grew up in. And, but then I realized that, you know, with the exception of like Philadelphia, you know, gay life from decades ago is just not very well documented. I remember talking to the most renowned historian of Youngstown, and I asked him how much had been published about, you know, queer life, and he said not even a sentence. So I thought, this is such an opportunity to get some of this stuff down on paper, like it would be foolish not to take it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I thought that was great. And I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is, I mean, were you hoping to affect some sort of change by documenting this? Did you?
No, but I did hope that, you know, now instead of there being nothing about gay life in Youngstown in the 50s and 60s, there's something.
Yeah.
And that's not like a lot, but that's something important.
Yeah,
because you're not going to find any other place where talking about those bars that were so popular and so important to that population during those years.
Yeah.
You know, and I went to Youngstown and I drove through all those places where the bars were, and there's either like a highway there or there's just grass, and there's no, you'd have no way of knowing what had once been there.
Who was it that grew up in Youngstown?
Michael Sicara.
Yeah, Michael Sicara, yeah. That's right. That's right. So one of the more remarkable pieces to these murders is how the killer disposed of the bodies afterwards. So, and particularly how much time it would have taken to do what he did, at least in a couple of the cases. Can you talk a little bit about that for the listeners?
Yeah, the first victim, Peter, was he was, I suppose, literally dismembered, but not completely dismembered. You know, his penis had been cut off and shoved down his throat. The subsequent victims were completely either dismembered or disarticulated, Into,
and what's the difference, if you could explain that?
Dismembering tends to be cruder. You're just cutting through the bone. Disarticulation is you're cutting around it. And disarticulation tends to be more difficult and is thought to indicate some kind of medical training.
And that took, I think you had spoken to somebody who had, who said that it should take around 6 hours to do something like that.
Yeah, the detective said it had interviewed someone who had done it.
Mm-hmm.
And, but the detectives believed that the dismemberments and the disarticulation, it wasn't done out of any kind of bloodlust. It was done purely out of convenience. The reason they felt that the first victim was not dismembered is because he was in the last probably months of living with AIDS, and he had wasted away to such a degree that he just kind of fit in a bag, and, you know, which is horrific. And the other victims were much larger, and it, you know, it was thought it was pure convenience to cut them up.
Well, I mean, he must have known a little bit about what he was doing. So the murderer,
absolutely,
is a nurse. Richard Rogers is his name. I didn't know whether it's not really a spoiler alert because it's all over the news.
I don't consider anything in the book to be a spoiler.
So yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah. So, but he was a nurse at Mount Sinai, and he lived and worked on Staten Island, which is
lived on Staten Island.
Yeah, lived on Staten.
Worked in Manhattan.
Yes, there was a Mount Sinai on Staten Island. I don't think that's where
there
he
was
worked.
Not. There was.
Oh, there was not.
There was a what was the name? There was the famous hospital in the village that treated a lot of the early AIDS patients.
Mm-hmm.
There was a hospital with the same name on Staten Island.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so, but he lived there, and I guess what's been, it was just, I think it's just really interesting how you chose to focus on the lives of the victims, which I think is you don't usually see that in crime stories. Although you did go through Richard's life as well. And I wondered, I don't know how much of what you wrote came from police reports versus actually talking to some of the victims' families. Did you speak to the victims' families?
Friends, families, classmates, ex-partners. Very little came from police sources.
Oh, wow. And I'm curious how they felt about you bringing this up. I mean, is this something that people were willing to talk about, or was it painful for them? Or
for the most part, yes, absolutely. I mean, it was painful for them.
But yeah.
Only a few people, you know, just said no outright or were upset about it. For the most part, when I explained what I was doing, that I wanted to flesh out their lives as much as possible and to effectively write like little mini biographies, people understood, you know, the usefulness in that and were happy to help in whatever small way they could. And plus, you know, they generally realized that I was putting in the work, and so it wasn't going to be wasted.
Yeah. So we are going to take a quick break. And we will be right back.
The WRFG Labor Day Blues Barbecue is back. Please join us at the Park Tavern in Piedmont Park on Monday, September 6th for a great afternoon of live blues. Here's the lineup. Sandra Hall, Atlanta's Empress of the Blues and the city's leading female blues singer. Backing up Sandra Hall, The Shadows. Blind Willie's House Band. They're back from a 16-month hiatus and featuring a new guitar player, Rick Inkle. Little G. Weeble. He's back in the U.S. from Budapest for just 2 weeks. His latest CD has been nominated for a Blues Blast Music Award. Garrett Collins Project, they're the 2019 Atlanta Blues Challenge winner. If you haven't heard them, they're a funky blues rock power trio. And Skylar Softly, he's a rising star from Phoenix City, Alabama. Plays 50s-style Chicago blues plus jump and swing. The Park Tavern will, of course, be selling tasty barbecue and cool libations. Blues barbecue tickets go on sale Saturday, August 7th. They're $17 if you buy them in advance via WRFG.org or $22 at the door. Kids under 12 will get in free. We look forward to seeing you at the 36th annual WRFG Labor Day Blues Barbecue, Monday, September 6th at the Park Tavern in Piedmont Park. The doors will open at 11 a.m. The music will start at noon. The Park Tavern is located at 10th Street and Monroe Drive Northeast in Midtown Atlanta. Additional funding provided by Fulton County Arts and Culture. Proceeds benefit WRFG 89.3 FM, your independent community radio station for progressive information and hand-picked quality music.
Piano Man by Billy Joel. For those of you that are just joining us, you're listening to WRFG Atlanta, 89.3 FM on your dial, streaming at WRFG.org. And this is Alternative Perspectives. This is Atlanta's only local radio hour devoted exclusively to issues affecting the queer community. And we are talking to Alon Green, who is the author of a book that came out in March of this year, Last Call, that chronicles the story of a killer who brutally murdered and dismembered four gay men in New York City between 1991 and 1993. But it wasn't his only person that he killed. It wasn't only those four people. Seems like the first murder happened way back in the 70s, right?
1973. And were it not for that murder and acquittal, he would not have been caught.
Mm-hmm. Because of the fingerprints that were kept. The fingerprints that were on the bags, the garbage bags, could not be the technology.
Yeah. Right. Well, there hadn't originally been the technology available to lift, you know, truly good fingerprints, but also the fingerprints that had been lifted off of it just weren't matching anything in the various systems. And so it wasn't until, about 20 years after the first killing in New York in 1991, that investigators were able to match them to this murder case from 1973 where, you know, he'd gotten away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and one of the other things in the book that was so interesting to me is, and I don't know if you did this, if you knew this before, but you've had to have learned a hell of a lot about solving crimes and about the way police departments work.
I learned as I went along.
Yeah.
I didn't have any kind of prior knowledge about almost anything in this book before I did it. And I think that the best kind of journalism is when you're learning as you go. And, whether it be the several hours I spent interviewing a man about what it was like to be a typesetter at the New York Law Journal in 1990-1991, I didn't have the slightest idea, but he walked me through it because that's how you create a reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And the people that were in the police department and in, I guess, the local government officials, and also the other police departments. I mean, what was it like talking to these people? Was there any regret or defensiveness on their part for not being able to catch this person sooner?
No. You know, they were, generally speaking, very forthright about why things hadn't been solved, about their own failures, about where they hit roadblocks. But I think one of the reasons why they didn't mind talking to me and, in fact, were generally eager to talk is because for all the problems that they had, they ultimately caught them. And so even though it was delayed justice, it was justice and it was a win. And, you know, I think this would have been a much different situation if the case had been unsolved.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't doubt that you're right. Talk, if you could, a little bit about how he, this gentleman was eventually arrested in New York City, because there was a little bit of a scandal about that.
Yes, although not as much of a scandal as it probably should have been.
Yeah.
You know, once Richard W. Rogers had been identified and there had been the match, the fingerprint match identified to the garbage bags, investigators realized that although they knew his name and they knew what he did for a living and they knew where he lived, they didn't really know much about him beyond that. They didn't know his routine. They didn't know if he owned other property, if he had other bank accounts, you know, what his day-to-day life was like. And so they asked the NYPD if they would surveil him for, you know, a couple of days or for a week just to see if they could pick up any further information. You know, maybe, although the chance was small, maybe they'd catch him in the act. Who knows? But the idea was to, you know, when they finally arrested him, was to really catch him off guard and to surprise him and to not have the time to, you know, come up with, you know, some kind of story and to be evasive. And so the NYPD agreed to do this. And I think it was maybe Memorial Day weekend or something like that. And all the detectives are home, you know, barbecuing and relaxing, and they're very excited about the upcoming surveillance. And then they all get phone calls saying, you know, Richard Rogers has been arrested, and he is currently sitting in One Police Plaza, which is the headquarters in Manhattan, so you better get over here. And what had happened was, is that Rogers, you know, of course, was a nurse at Mount Sinai, and it just so happened that Helen Giuliani, the mother of then mayor Rudolph Giuliani, was a patient at the hospital, and the pathological liar, incompetent police commissioner Bernard Kerik had made the decision to get Rogers out of there as quickly as possible, even though Helen Giuliani was not at all, you know, among the target group. And in doing so, he short-circuited the investigation and probably lost a great deal of valuable information in the process.
The only two of the four deaths that are in the book he was convicted for.
Well, that's all he was tried for.
Yeah, tried for. Right.
The reason for that is because detectives could never establish a primary crime scene. In other words, they couldn't establish where these men had been killed. And because of that, jurisdiction was dictated by where the bodies were left. And, you know, the second and third victims were left in New Jersey. And it also just so happened that those two cases had the most evidence. Yeah. They were the best cases to prosecute, and so they did. There were problems with the other, you know, cases, but there's no doubt that one person committed all four.
Yeah, well, and I mean, on the one hand, it's good that he's behind bars, but as far as the family and the friends of the victims are concerned, those crimes remain unsolved, and who knows how many other crimes. You know, this guy drove all over the country and took, you know, large swaths of time off from work where he could do these things.
Yeah, detectives tend to think that the true body count is in the dozens.
Yeah, that's what I would think as well. So I guess just in the few minutes that we have left here, I kind of want to kind of back out from the individual story. And I guess one of the things I'm wondering is, what is it that, because, you know, you obviously have immersed yourself for 3 years, I think you spent on this, in this world of, amongst other thing, you know, what it was like to be a gay man. And I'm wondering what surprised you about that, or what did you learn that you feel like you didn't already know?
I think that, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I was about 12 years old when the first murder in New York occurred, and I'm old enough to remember that period of the AIDS epidemic and Ryan White. And I'm old enough to remember a lot of the, you know, incorrect information that was going around about transmission and toilet seats and that sort of thing. And I knew before I started the book, I knew that, you know, there was a great deal of anti-queer violence from that period. But I think what I kept learning is that although I, you know, had some memory of all this stuff, I had absolutely no idea how violent that period was and how much the AIDS epidemic seemed to influence that violence and feed into it and exacerbate it, or at least give people the excuse to exacerbate it. I just had no idea how relentless it was. And I was just struck by how, you know, every edition of the Daily News or the New York Post or whatever that I picked up, you know, there was another story of a man being beaten or killed. And it was nonstop. Yeah. And, you know, the numbers that I was given from both academics and people from the Anti-Violence Project, you know, bore that out. I mean, the numbers are astronomical.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is, and actually I didn't know that myself either. So I appreciated that. I didn't know the connection between the violence and how it increased kind of as part of the response to the HIV epidemic. The other thing, another thing that I learned that I guess I didn't know was, you know, part of what you talked about when you were talking in Youngstown, you kind of went back into the Stonewall days and, you know, late 60s, early 70s. And you were talking about how people in Youngstown some of them didn't necessarily want to go to New York City as gay men.
That was my favorite story. I mean, I remember, you know, sitting in a diner in Youngstown with these two guys who were in their 80s. And they'd been together since the early 60s. And so they were the guys who gave me all the information about Youngstown. They had worked in those bars, been patrons. They knew that up and down. And, you know, I asked them how Stonewall, you know, was greeted by the, you know, gay men in Youngstown. And they basically said they thought it was just bizarre, you know, because in Youngstown, they tended to be left alone in the bars, and the cops tended to leave them alone. And of course they were fair game once they were out on the street, but in the bars, you know, that was their space. And so they looked at what was happening around the Stonewall Inn and thought, like, there they're rioting just to be allowed to have a drink. Like they couldn't understand it. And, you know, in a way, I thought of it as, you know, it's as if you're watching the moon landing, but like from Earth. It was just so far removed from that right. pivotal event that you have the luxury of experiencing it from a real remove.
Well, I think it's just ironic. It's just it's completely the opposite from what you would think. You know that you know to a certain extent. You know, it's a lot easier to be gay out in Youngstown, Ohio, than it would be in, you know, this liberal mecca, New York City. You wouldn't think that you'd be bothered as much, but it turns out you're bothered more.
You know, so. Because each area, whether it be San Francisco or New York or Youngstown or any place that has any significant gay population in those years, they're all going to have their individual challenges, and none of them are going to be the same. Some of the bars are going to be run by the mob. Some of them are not. Some of them are going to pay off the cops. Some won't. And each of these communities have their own unique ways of getting by.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the Youngstown guys, that was what they knew. The New York guys, they had their own, you know, set of constraints.
I wonder if those men in Youngstown that you were talking to, maybe they probably weren't real up for joining the fight the next year. Maybe they.
No, they very much were.
Oh,
I mean,
good.
They understood that, like, they knew that they were not living under ideal conditions. I mean, you know, as they, the common term at the time, you know, they knew that San Francisco was the Emerald City. And, you know, quite often guys they knew would just pack up and go to San Francisco. They knew that there were better places to be, but,
yeah.
You know, they just had this very specific, particular reaction to Stonewall that I felt was worth sharing.
Yeah, no, I thought that was cool. I liked it myself. In fact, I mean, the whole thing about Youngstown, I thought was really interesting because it's just not something, you don't even think there's a gay community there, you know, but there's gay communities everywhere.
And you know, part of it is that I think it's been so long since Youngstown was an economically and culturally sort of famous place. But it was for so long because mm-hmm. of the steel industry. You know, Ella Fitzgerald used to fly into Youngstown for her birthday because it was such a hot place to be for so many years.
Well,
and, you know, now it's one of the more, you know, depressed places I've ever visited.
So just a couple more things. I got one thing, and I'm kind of struggled with how to ask this. I'm just going to. So your book explores the lives of these four gay men, as well as the perpetrator and the families that surround them. It becomes clear that all five of these individuals have struggled with their sexuality, which is, you know, it's almost like a separate story in and of itself, or it could be out, you know, outside of the murders, although it obviously played a role in why it took so long to capture this man, somewhat to a certain extent, it played a role. But the perpetrator, again, had his own issues. It would seem accepting his own sexuality. And this is the part where I'm not really sure how to say this, but I had this idea that one could argue that some sort of a unstated premise of the book is that society's treatment of gay men could be partially responsible for both the delay in solving the murders, as well as the men themselves that were murdered, putting themselves in situations that were dangerous, but then also the murderer himself. You know, and what led him to do this. I'm sure a lot of people would take issue with that premise, but.
So I agree with some of that premise.
Yeah.
I definitely agree that, you know, I think that probably delayed the solving of the case a little bit, although I couldn't say exactly how.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you know, I wouldn't say that because they were in the closet, they put themselves in this situation. What I would say is that because of the societal constraints, those constraints put them in a terrible situation, and that the inability for them to be able to live the lives they wanted made them more vulnerable than they otherwise would have been.
About the murderer?
Well, so what I found interesting, you know, at first when I was working on the book, I was completely uninterested in him. I wasn't planning to do a chapter on him, but I ended up having to do one because it was sort of solving a narrative problem. And I had to sort of account for about 5.5 years when the case was cold. So I decided, okay, I'll just write about what he was doing instead. And so in doing so, you know, I had already done the research on his life and I had interviewed people. So I had the material. And it occurred to me, you know, halfway through that chapter, that while Richard Rogers was, you know, in many ways a despicable, depraved person, he was also a despicable, depraved person who was of the same generation as the men he killed to some degree, and was like them, living under the same constraints, the same policies, you know, federal and state, and that he obviously was reacting differently and making different, you know, despicable choices, but, you know, he was suffering under the these burdens as well.
Mm-hmm. And I guess finally, and you know, you can look this guy up. I mean, and this man is, I mean, he's the definition of unassuming for sure. I mean, it's quite amazing to look at a picture of this man and imagine that this is, that he did all of these things. But is he still maintaining his innocence?
Always has.
Yeah. And have you ever considered, I guess you said you weren't interested in him. Is that
I still wrote him 3 letters and I still put in 2 requests to interview him in person. I mean,
that's what I was going to ask you.
But he had no interest in talking to me.
No interest.
I think because he probably suspected correctly that I didn't think he was innocent.
Right. Well, I guess this man will go to his grave in prison.
Almost certainly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about this. Again, the book is Last Call, a true story of love, lust, and murder in queer New York. It came out in March, and I would recommend it for anybody. I mean, if you're into crime, obviously, you're going to be crime books. You're going to be interested in that, but it also has a lot to teach us about what was going on in the gay community and in society in general over the last 40, 50 years as it relates to gay men. So I think that's awesome. And thank you again. I appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
And that's going to do it for the show. I am so glad that you listened. Next up, we have Peach State Festival. And again, as I said at the beginning of the show, if you haven't gotten vaccinated, please get vaccinated. Please quit being stupid. We'll see you next week.